Hi, this is Ted, and for the next hour, you'll be listening to a reading of Articles and Futures from the Monday, September 29th, New York Times, from the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. A terrible article. Russian drones and missiles batter Kyiv for 12 hours, by Mark Santora. Russia attacked the Ukrainian capital and other cities across the country on Sunday with nearly 600 drones and dozens of missiles, killing at least four people in Kyiv and injuring dozens more in an hours-long attack. A massive Russian attack on Ukraine lasted for more than 12 hours, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine said in a statement. Savage strikes, a deliberate targeted terror against ordinary cities. The Ukrainian Air Force said the attack started at 8:30 p.m. on Saturday and continued into Sunday morning. Nearly 600 drones and 48 missiles were launched in the assault, it said in a statement, adding that five missiles and 31 drones had evaded air defenses. Ukrainian officials said that more than 70 people were wounded across the country, including two rescue workers. They warned that the number of dead and injured was likely to rise as 1,500 rescue workers and police officers were deployed across 11 regions to treat the wounded and search for survivors. Mr. Zelensky vowed to respond to the latest strikes as he urged Ukraine's allies to maintain pressure on Russia to agree to an immediate ceasefire. This vile attack came virtually as the close of UN General Assembly week, and this is exactly how Russia declares its true position, he said. During his visit to New York for the annual gathering at the United Nations last week, Mr. Zelensky sought to convince world leaders that Russia's war in Ukraine had set off, quote, the most destructive arms race in human history, unquote, and that the violence ravaging his country would most likely spread. Officials said that Kyiv, the capital, was the primary target of Sunday's attack and that a 12-year-old girl was among the dead. Ukraine's cardiology institute was damaged, officials said, along with an industrial bakery, a tire manufacturing plant, homes, and apartment buildings. The Polish embassy and the European Union delegation's building also suffered damage in the attack, said Polish EU officials. At least 38 people were injured in the southern city of Zaporizhzhia in Russian rocket attacks that damaged at least 14 apartment buildings, Ukrainian officials said. Attacks were also reported in Sumy, Odessa, and other parts of the country. Since launching its full-scale invasion in February 2022, Russian aerial assaults have ravaged Ukraine's energy grid, targeted military production facilities, battered critical railway hubs, and struck other vital infrastructures. The attacks have also targeted residential neighborhoods in what military analysts have described as a campaign intended to break the Ukrainian will to fight. While the Russian military has failed to achieve any significant breakthrough on the front in recent months, Moscow has increased the scale of its bombardments in an effort to overwhelm Ukrainian air defenses. Russia has been using more and more attack drones in its assaults, having drastically stepped up production and manufacturing of the weapons. Ukraine, meanwhile, has increased its own long-range strikes inside Russia. But the surge in Russia's drone supply, coupled with new technology and tactics, has created a challenge for Ukraine, which enjoyed an advantage in drone warfare early in the war that Moscow has since worn down. That all has added urgency to the race to develop countermeasures. General Oleksandr Sirsky, Ukraine's top military commander, told reporters in Kyiv last week that Ukraine had created a new branch of the Air Force focused on unmanned air defense systems to help counter the growing threat. He said that Ukraine was also equipping helicopters with specialized equipment to target drones and has experimented with using light aircraft with machine gun mounts. At the same time, Ukraine continues to rely on its Western allies for sophisticated air defense systems to protect against Russia's most powerful ballistic missiles. Mr. Zelensky said on Saturday that his country recently received a Patriot system from Israel, with two more such systems expected to come in the fall. He did not say which country would provide the additional systems. The American-made Patriot is one of the few systems capable of reliably intercepting ballistic missiles. Ukrainian officials credit the system with saving thousands of lives. Hours before the latest bombardment, Mr. Zelensky warned once again that the Kremlin had ambitions beyond Ukraine, saying that recent incursions by Russian drones and fighter jets into NATO airspace posed a direct challenge to the alliance. He said Russia is testing Europe's ability to defend itself and trying to influence societies so that people start thinking, why are we giving so much to Ukrainians, but we can't protect ourselves? This is to reduce aid to Ukraine, especially before winter. Another depressing article. I'm sorry to be reading depressing articles, but the news is depressing. This is called Defiance, Fear, and Hope in Venezuela as U.S. Warships Lurk. This is by Julie Turkowitz. In one corner of Venezuela's capital, hundreds of government supporters held guns to their chests as one speaker after another, microphone in hand, urged them to defend the nation with their lives. In another corner, businessmen and diplomats worried about the escalating tensions between Venezuela and the United States, about what they see as a lost opportunity for dialogue between the two countries, and about the possibility of a U.S. strike that could unleash bloodshed and chaos. Still, in other parts of the capital, Caracas, there was a battle-weary calm and skepticism that there will ever be political change in Venezuela. Granted a rare visa for foreign journalists, I spent a week in Venezuela at a particularly tense time. Relations with the United States are at a crossroads, with the Trump administration sending warships into the Caribbean. The buildup size and President Trump's public threats against President Nicolas Maduro have raised the specter of strikes, of commando raids in the South American nation, or of some broader conflict. President Trump has said he wants to unleash the military on cartels and stop trafficking to the United States, and his administration has called Mr. Maduro the head of a terrorist organization threatening the United States and flooding it with drugs. The United States says it has blown up at least three drug smuggling boats in the Caribbean, including at least two from Venezuela, in a significant escalation of the kind of pressure that Trump has put on Mexico to crack down on fentanyl. But while some drugs do come from Venezuela, fentanyl does not, and the cocaine that does is a very small percentage of the trade, far less than what comes from Colombia and exits from Colombia and Ecuador, according to the U.S. government accounting. That has led many observers to say that the Trump administration's real goal is to go after Maduro. In interviews, some Venezuelans said they supported any actions that would lead to the ouster of Maduro, who was accused of major human rights violations and whose movement has led the country for a generation. The group supporting the use of force is led by Maria Corina Machado, an opposition leader. Her base says that by removing Maduro, the United States could defend the result of last year's presidential vote, which Maduro is widely believed to have lost. Independent vote monitors in many countries, including the United States, recognized Maduro's opponent, Edmundo Gonzalez, a surrogate for Ms. Machado, as the legitimate victor. One of Ms. Machado's advisors, Pedro Urachuro, said she was coordinating with the Trump administration and had a plan for the first 100 hours after Maduro's fall. That plan involves the participation of international allies, he said, especially the United States, and would guarantee a stable transition to Mr. Gonzalez. But in interviews, other Venezuelans were far less eager to see the United States get involved. Many, even those who said they wanted to see Maduro gone, arguing that he is held on only through repression, said that a violent U.S. move was not the solution. Many people spoke on condition of anonymity, fearing retaliation. Some said they doubted the willingness of the United States to keep a large contingent of troops on the ground to ensure the stability of a U.S.-backed government. Three diplomats said they saw few signs that anyone in Maduro's inner circle would split to support an opposition leader or that the military would turn on him. Other Venezuelans warned that ousting Maduro would only invite the armed actors left behind, the military, Colombia's guerrilla groups, paramilitary gangs, into a battle for the spoils. And in Venezuela, with its oil, gold, and other minerals, there are many spoils. You kill Maduro, said one prominent businessman, you turn Venezuela into Haiti, which descended into chaos after its last president was assassinated. Still others were skeptical that Trump was willing to get involved militarily and said that the president's gunboat strategy led by Secretary of State Marcus Rubio would only push Venezuela further from the United States and toward China, Russia, and Iran. Maduro has responded to Washington's mobilization by arming civilians, sending tanks into the streets, and announcing military exercises throughout the country, which have been publicized on state television and social media. But his advisors say the central message to Washington is that their government does not want war. The Venezuelan president sent a letter to Trump this month praising his efforts to halt other conflicts and said that he was open to a direct and frank conversation with Trump's special envoy to Venezuela, Richard Grenell. Earlier this year, Mr. Grenell seemed to be trying to improve relations, traveling to Venezuela to meet with Maduro just after Trump took office. But more recently, Trump appears to favor Mr. Rubio's hardline approach. In an interview at her office inside the country's oil ministry building, Vice President Delcy Rodriguez said that she believed that Trump was leading the world into a stage where the United States has openly declared war on the world. The Ministry of Defense is no longer defense, it's the Ministry of War, she said. Trade relations are no longer trade relations, they are a trade war. She called the boat attacks absolutely illegal and called for a normalization of economic relations with the United States, which has imposed sanctions on Venezuela's vital oil industry. The people of the U.S. do not want war in the Caribbean, she said. Even amid escalating tensions, Venezuela has continued to accept twice-weekly flights of deportees from the United States, said the country's foreign minister, Ivan Duque. Several diplomats and business leaders in Caracas said that they hoped the United States would shift back to a policy of diplomacy, believing that persistent negotiations could eventually persuade Maduro to hand power to a reformist successor or moderate opposition leader in exchange for sanctions relief and other conditions. They also said that he is tired but cannot leave office if he thinks he will be arrested. Maduro, who is 62 and has led the country since 2013, is under indictment in the United States on drug conspiracy charges. On the streets of Caracas, the strain between the two nations has produced contrasting images of war and peace. On a recent day, a downtown boulevard filled with people the government had gathered for a rally. Some civilians, others members of the Bolivarian military, a reserve force. Some people said that they worked for the government, that their superiors had required attendance, and they had been given unloaded guns to hold during the event. Many hurried to leave as soon as it ended. Others said that patriotism had brought them out and vowed to defend Maduro and his movement. If there is an invasion, said Marisol Amundare, 50, I will safeguard my children and head to the streets with my rifle. In other parts of the city, though, normal life continued. Not far from the presidential palace one morning, Constanza Sofia Arangeran twirled on a cobblestone street in a gold ball gown as a photographer snapped away. And you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. She was preparing for her 15th birthday celebration, and her mother was more anxious about the coming party than a possible invasion. No one interviewed said they were hoarding supplies. Some said they were not worried about an attack. Others said they couldn't afford to. In a normal country where there is a threat like this, the first thing people do is stock up on food, said Estefania Mendoza, 42, a social worker with two children. But we can't do that. While the country's economy has recovered somewhat since a protracted crisis helped fuel a migrant exodus, the rebound has been uneven. Trump and Rubio have argued that significant amounts of cocaine are trafficked through Venezuela and that they are seeking to stop U.S. overdoses. A 2020 report from the U.S. State Department said just 10% to 13% of the global cocaine supply Trump fires U.S. attorney after she cautions official of Border Patrol on raids, by Heather Knight and Hamed Al-Aziz. For 15 years, Michelle Beckwith oversaw some of the toughest federal prosecutions in California. She went after transnational terrorists, sex traffickers, and the Aryan Brotherhood. She became the acting U.S. attorney in Sacramento this year, where her boss, a Biden appointee, stepped down in January. But her career crumbled in July. She said, after she issued a warning to Gregory Bovino, the California face of President Trump's immigration crackdown. The dismissal of Ms. Beckwith appeared to be an early example of how Trump has fired top federal prosecutors who did not help carry out his political agenda. Last week, Trump fired a U.S. attorney in Virginia who determined there was insufficient evidence to indict James Comey, the former FBI director, and Letitia James, the New York State Attorney General, both political targets of the president. The Virginia prosecutor was replaced by a Trump loyalist who persuaded a federal grand jury on Thursday to indict Mr. Comey on two counts. She was also Trump's private lawyer and had no prosecutorial experience. Documents reviewed by the New York Times show that the July 15th firing of Ms. Beckwith occurred less than 6 hours after she told Mr. Bovino, the Border Patrol chief in charge of Southern California raids, that a court order prevented him from arresting people without probable cause in a vast expanse that stretches from the Oregon border to Bakersfield. She was removed not only from her post as acting U.S. attorney in the Eastern District of California, but from the office altogether. "It's unjust," she said of the firings across the federal government this year in an interview. "We have to stand up and insist the laws be followed." Ms. Beckwith, a Democrat, was replaced temporarily by Kimberly Sanchez, a Republican who also worked in the Eastern District. 2 days later, Mr. Bovino and his agents went to Sacramento and raided a Home Depot parking lot where they said they arrested at least 8 people for being in the country without authorization. "Folks, there is no such thing as a sanctuary city," Bovino said in a video he shared on social media. With a holstered gun on his hip and canisters secured to his vest as he stood in front of the state capitol. "Whether it's here in Sacramento or nationwide, we're here and we're not going anywhere." The end of Ms. Beckwith's federal career was precipitated by a phone call from Bovino on July 14. He told her that he was bringing his officers to Sacramento, about 600 miles north of the Mexico border, and he wanted to know whom to notify in her office if they were assaulted. Ms. Beckwith said she reminded him that the Border Patrol was under a federal court order prohibiting it from stopping people indiscriminately in her district. It was clear, she said, that he knew about the order, but didn't seem to think it would stop him. At 10:57 the next morning, she emailed Bovino to reiterate that she expected compliance with court orders and the Constitution. Hours later, her work cell phone went dark. Then her computer did, too. She checked her personal email account. At 4:31 p.m., she received an email from Saurabh Sharma, special assistant to Trump. Michelle, it stated, on behalf of President Donald Trump, I am writing to inform you that your position as First Assistant United States Attorney and employment with the Department of Justice terminated, effective immediately. Ms. Beckwith was promptly marched out of the office. A spokeswoman for Trump referred questions to the Department of Justice, which declined to comment on the matter. That's called transparency. A Department of Homeland Security official who was part of the Sacramento operation and spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly, said that federal officials were offended by Ms. Beckwith's suggestion that immigration agents were going to violate the rights of immigrants. What's more, the official said, Bovino felt that Ms. Beckwith was refusing to provide his team the legal support it needed to safely conduct the operations. In a statement, Bovino said the former acting U.S. attorney's email suggesting that the United States Border Patrol does not always abide by the Constitution revealed a bias against law enforcement. Ms. Beckwith's impasse with Bovino was rooted in a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union after his border agents conducted the unannounced raids in Bakersfield, where they arrested day laborers outside a Home Depot and farm workers in orchards. A federal judge in April ruled that the Border Patrol could detain people only if they had a reasonable suspicion that they were violating federal immigration law. You just can't walk up to people with brown skin and say, "Give me your papers," U.S. District Court Judge Jennifer Thurston said. She granted an injunction stopping the Border Patrol from detaining people without probable cause while the case proceeds. But that order did not apply to Southern California, where federal officials intensified their crackdown in June, leading to protests and Trump's deployment of the National Guard against the wishes of California leaders. A Los Angeles judge in July also placed restrictions on immigration raids in Southern California, but the Supreme Court overruled her decision this month. The Supreme Court's decision is evidence of the fact Border Patrol follows the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment, said Bovino. There are 93 U.S. attorneys overseeing federal prosecutions in districts throughout the country. It's common for them, as appointees, to resign after a new president is elected. It is not common, however, for presidents to demand that prosecutors carry out certain acts as a condition of employment, said Nina Mendelson, a professor of law at the University of Michigan with expertise in administrative law. U.S. attorneys are supposed to be able to operate freely from political pressure. We still have a norm of prosecutorial independence and even-handedness and integrity at the federal level, she said. Political pressure to prosecute enemies or shield friends would not typically be considered cause for removal. In August, Attorney General Pam Bondi appointed Eric Grant, who defended the Trump administration against major environmental lawsuits during the president's first term, as interim U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of California. Grant replaced Ms. Sanchez, who is now second in command in the office, the position that Ms. Beckwith once held. Ms. Mendelson said the firing of longtime civil servants without cause, as in the case of Ms. Beckwith, is rare. Ms. Beckwith said that while the president had the right to remove her as acting U.S. attorney, he should have allowed her to return to prosecutorial work in the Eastern District. Ms. Beckwith has appealed her termination, arguing she could not be fired without cause and without due process. She is seeking to have her removal expunged from her record, as well as back pay with interest and attorney's fees. Ms. Beckwith said she was motivated by justice, not politics. She was raised in Ohio by a father who worked in a fiberglass factory and a mother who stayed home to take care of her and her sister. They did not talk about politics. She and her husband, also a lawyer, moved to California in 2004 for work and eventually decided to raise their family in Davis, a college town west of Sacramento, where she is a member of the school PTA. Though she is a registered Democrat, she pointed out that she has served Republican and Democratic presidents alike. "I'm an American who cares about her country," she said. "I'm a public servant. That is my calling." Trump's unproven autism claims belied by millions for credible studies. By Benjamin Mueller. In late May, when the Trump administration issued a call for new research investigating the causes of autism, many scientists feared that anti-vaccine politics would decide which projects received funding. The call for proposals seemingly gave health officials greater control than usual over the vetting process. Researchers had only weeks to propose studies. And with Health Secretary Robert Kennedy spreading the debunked theory that vaccines caused autism, potential applicants worried openly that the Trump administration might bless only those research projects that would prop up his favored conclusions. So scientists were cautiously optimistic last week to find that the 13 projects chosen to receive funding from the National Institutes of Health were nothing of the sort. The projects, which were awarded a combined $50 million, drew on diverse sets of patient data. They were grounded in decades of credible autism science, and they planned to examine how strong genetic explanations for the disease interacted with environmental influences to determine someone's risk of developing autism. They represented, in short, the very opposite approach to one that came into focus last week in an explosive news briefing at the White House. Unproven claims that Tylenol caused autism, along with a barrage of disproved theories that childhood vaccines were dangerous and had driven up rates of the disease as well. We're very enthusiastic and very optimistic that these projects will lead to important answers no matter what questions they're looking at, said Alicia Halliday, the chief science officer at the Autism Science Foundation. The chosen projects, she said, had to do with everything from toxicants to nutrition to early contextual factors like socioeconomic status. Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, the director of the NIH, the world's premier leader of medical research, stood beside Trump and Kennedy at the White House on Monday to announce the research awards. His comments were quickly overshadowed by Trump's strident warnings about acetaminophen, which he couldn't pronounce, the active ingredient in Tylenol and childhood vaccines. Many autism scientists blanched at the president's claims, and even as they took heart from the research projects awarded NIH funding last week, many of them remained wary of the wider body of autism research being pushed by the Trump administration. That includes a vaccine safety review that Kennedy entrusted to David Geyer, a steadfast figure in the anti-vaccine movement, who also has publicized the long debunked theory that vaccines cause autism. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said recently that it intended to award a contract for investigating a link between vaccines and autism to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in New York. And many autism researchers saw their federal funding slashed or delayed earlier this year as the Trump administration purged studies related to disfavored topics like gender and diversity. A quick pause. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. But for now, the NIH effort, known as the Autism Data Science Initiative, offered researchers a measure of reassurance about the direction of the field. Dr. Bhattacharya said last week that more than 250 research teams had sought funding. Judith Miller, an associate professor at the Center for Autism Research at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, helps lead a team that was awarded funding to examine the interplay of genetic and environmental factors related to autism. The team is looking at, among other things, changes in the diagnostic criteria for autism, air and water quality, green space, poverty, and early childhood intervention. We have known there's a big genetic component, and the genetics account for about 80% of the identifiable causes of autism, Dr. Miller said. But even when we know the genetic cause, that doesn't really tell us very much about the outcome or how to specifically help that individual. Her team is relying on a large set of maternal and childhood health data from Philadelphia. Researchers will be allowed to guard patient data closely, Dr. Miller said, dispelling fears that arose in the spring over the idea of a federal registry of autistic people. Jonathan Seibot, a leader in the field of autism genetics at the University of California, San Diego, was awarded funding as part of a team trying to use genetics to help investigate the role of environmental exposures in autism diagnoses. He had worried that the federal government was trying to vet research proposals so quickly that the quality of the reviews would suffer. But he said those fears were unfounded. The applications really did get a rigorous review. Dr. Seibot's project, he said, would shed light on the links that other studies have suggested between environmental factors and autism. The mechanism that explains these correlations is unclear, he said. The genetics of autism is a key piece of the puzzle that we have a good handle on. That helps the other pieces, including the environment, fall into place. Other projects will look at dietary and chemical exposures and factors predicting improved outcomes for autistic children. Autism experts marveled at the dissonance between the unproven theories touted by Trump on Monday and the well-founded research that another arm of his administration was pushing forward. To me, they came from different universes, said Helen Tagger Flusberg, the director of Boston University's Center for Autism Research Excellence and the founder of the Coalition of Autism Scientists. This is all very serious, forward-looking, exciting, rigorous, gold standard science. And here's a related article. As immunization rates fall, vaccine skepticism rises as wedge issue, by Tracy Tully. Jack Chattarelli, the Republican candidate for governor of New Jersey, stood in front of a debate audience last week and said that he supported childhood vaccines and the state's role in expanding the number of children who are immunized. 4 days later, Mr. Chattarelli was a featured guest in an event hosted by a group that has emerged as one of New Jersey's main opponents of mandatory vaccination. The keynote speaker was a doctor who has falsely claimed that the COVID-19 vaccine magnetizes patients. They can put a key on their forehead. It sticks. The doctor, Sherry Tenpenny, testified in 2021. They can put spoons and forks all over them, and they can stick. Footnote, that never happened to me. Mr. Chattarelli's appearance at the New Jersey Public Health Innovation Political Action Committee's Health Freedom Gala in Hazlitt, New Jersey on Thursday came as Trump's health secretary, Kennedy, has elevated immunization skeptics and limited access to COVID vaccines nationwide. On Monday, in an extraordinary White House address, Trump also warned pregnant women that Tylenol has been linked to autism in claims unsubstantiated by science. Mr. Chattarelli's appearance also came as a new independent poll showed the governor's race tightening and as each party's battle to energize its base intensified ahead of the November 4th election. Representative Mikey Sherrill, the Democratic nominee for governor, said Mr. Chattarelli's appearance at the gala showed we can't trust him to keep New Jersey kids safe and healthy. Jack is taking his cues from fringe activists, conspiracy theories, and the likes of Donald Trump and Kennedy, whose extreme policies will result in reduced access to vaccines and more of our children catching preventable illnesses, said Ms. Sherrill in a statement. She made a point in Sunday's debate of stressing the crucial role that vaccinations have played in eradicating diseases in the United States. New Jersey parents should be very worried, she told the audience, citing a growing number of measles cases in schools. These are eminently curable diseases, and we are allowing children to get sick and, yes, die because we are not appropriately following medical research vaccine protocol, she added. New Jersey's health commissioner reported this year that the state had lost its so-called herd immunity from measles, the immunization threshold needed to protect a community from rampant disease spread. In one of the state's Republican strongholds, Ocean County, vaccination rates have fallen to 85%, the lowest in the state. On Sunday, Mr. Cetarelli, who is running for governor for the third time and has been endorsed by Trump, said, "I support the vaccine schedule. We've got to get above the threshold of herd immunity to keep our community safe," he added. "The obligation of any governor on day one after taking the oath of office is the public health and safety." Earlier this month, however, in answering a question at a town hall, he said, "I would never mandate a vaccine. That's up to you." The challenge of restoring herd immunity will be steep for New Jersey's next governor. In 2019, before the COVID-19 pandemic, more than 90% of students in each of New Jersey's 21 counties were fully vaccinated, and more than half of the counties had immunization rates of 95% or above. This year, the rates of immunization for school children in five counties fell below 90%, and not a single county in New Jersey has immunized 95% of the students. Thursday's event, which featured a roughly 15-minute speech by Cetarelli, was closed to reporters. He entered through a side door of the catering hall and exited the same way, walking briskly to a waiting car and refusing to answer questions. The $200 a plate dinner is an annual event for a group whose stated mission is to protect the rights of New Jersey residents, quote, "to make all medical decisions for themselves and their families without coercion or undue constraint." Early in the night, Dr. Tenpenny was signing copies of her new book as women in full-length gowns and men in formal wear filtered past a registration desk topped with a bucket of stress balls stamped "Mandate Health Freedom." "It's not their role to protect us from ourselves," one guest, Roy Bryan, said of politicians. "Once you've got that, you have no more liberty." Vaccination mandates have proved to be politically potent in New Jersey, even before the pandemic sharpened the debate over immunizations. In January 2020, New Jersey lawmakers were poised to pass what would have been the nation's broadest ban on religious exemptions to childhood vaccines. A similar but less sweeping measure had earlier been adopted in New York amid a large measles outbreak in Brooklyn. Opponents of the legislation in New Jersey flooded the halls of the State House. Del Bigtree, an anti-vaccine activist from Texas, flew in to lead a day-long protest. Mr. Kennedy showed up, too. After weeks of sustained protest, the legislation collapsed. Less than a year later, the COVID-19 vaccine would be administered for the first time. Most New Jersey residents celebrated the vaccine's power to slow the deadly virus in a state that recorded more than 36,000 COVID-related fatalities. But some skeptics revolted against the scores of executive orders that the governor, Philip Murray, signed in the name of public health. When Mr. Cetarelli ran against Murphy in 2021, pandemic-related mandates tied to masks and vaccines helped to drive Republicans to the polls. Mr. Cetarelli lost to Murphy by a narrow margin. Stephen Sweeney, the powerful Senate president, who was one of the most vocal supporters of the ban on religious exemptions, lost his seat to an underfunded political novice. Mr. Cetarelli was interviewed by leaders of the Public Health Innovation PAC during the 2021 campaign. "I've always been about bold bodily autonomy," he said, according to the group's website. "I don't think government has any right to tell any individuals that they have to take a vaccine or a medicine." Attendees were reminded that Thursday's dinner was not just a celebration. It's a rally point for the 2025 election cycle, organizers wrote. Together we'll build momentum, strengthen our coalition, and show New Jersey that families are ready for leadership that defends our rights to die. And we will come close to our end with a David French editorial, as I do every week now. Make no mistake about what this has come to. There are times when I miss practicing law because right now there are few more important posts for defending the rule of law and the integrity of the American system of justice than on James Comey's defense team. Let's be clear, perfectly clear, about what happened last week. On Thursday, a federal grand jury acting on the urging of Trump's Department of Justice indicted Comey, the former director of the FBI. This indictment was the culmination of a transparently vindictive campaign by Trump to get revenge on his political enemies, no matter the facts or the law. Let's rewind the clock to May 2017. At the time, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election, and Trump was furious that he was implicated. Trump repeatedly demanded that aides speak out in his defense and was so angry that he was screaming at television clips about the investigation. While Trump has spent years denigrating the Russia hoax, it's important to remember that there was already evidence of serious misconduct on Trump's team. The stated justification for firing Comey was his alleged mishandling of the investigation of Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server for government business. For Trump, this justification was unquestionably a pretext. Days after Comey was fired, Trump told NBC News that he had intended to fire him regardless of the Department of Justice's recommendation, and the reason was the Russia investigation. "When I decided to just do it," he told NBC's Lester Holt, "I said to myself, I said, you know, the Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election that they should have won." Sure should have. The Russia hoax is central to MAGA's persecution narrative, and Trump has had a thirst for revenge ever since. He's repeatedly attacked Comey in quotes, comments, and interviews. He campaigned to be elected president last year, promising retribution. Now Trump is getting exactly what he wants. The sequence of events is startling. On September 19th, Eric Siebert, the acting U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, who was initially selected by Trump, resigned after Trump told reporters, "I want him out." Siebert had been investigating two Trump opponents, Comey and Letitia James, the Attorney General of New York. Both cases had hit roadblocks. Siebert reportedly had concerns about the strength of the evidence against both Comey and James. Trump, however, didn't care. He wanted his indictments, and he wanted them now. On September 20th, he posted an extraordinary public message that was directed to his Attorney General, Pam Bondi. "Pam," it began, "I have reviewed over 30 statements and posts saying that essentially same old story as last time, all talk, no action. Nothing is being done. What about Comey, Adam Shifty Schiff, like Letitia? They're all guilty as hell, but nothing is going to be done." He indicated that he was promoting Lindsay Halligan, one of his former personal attorneys, to take Siebert's place, and ended with this directive: "We can't delay any longer. It's killing our reputation and credibility. They impeached me twice and indicted me five times." And then capital letters, "Over nothing. Justice must be served now. Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point." After Halligan assumed office on September 22nd, federal prosecutors reportedly presented her with a memorandum detailing the weaknesses in the case against Comey. No matter. She pressed on, reportedly presenting the case against Comey to the grand jury herself. And on September 25th, she secured a simple two-count indictment against Comey, for allegedly lying to Congress and for allegedly obstructing justice. She had tried to secure a 3-count indictment, but in a highly unusual move, it's a famous saying in the legal profession that a decent prosecutor can even persuade a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. The grand jury refused to indict on one of the counts. The indictment is so short and so bereft of detail that it's hard to determine the factual allegations in the case. Jake Tapper of CNN is reporting that sources tell him that the indictment is related to an FBI investigation called Arctic Haze that was looking into leaks to news outlets reporting on the origins of the Russia investigation. According to CNN, investigators examined whether Comey authorized Daniel Richmond, a friend of his who was a law professor at Columbia University, to leak information to the media. Did I say that you're listening to a reading of articles and features on the from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service? No one doubts that Richmond spoke to the media in Comey's defense, but the redacted documents from the Arctic Haze investigation reveal that he told investigators that Comey never asked him to talk to the media. They conclude with this statement: the investigation has not yielded sufficient evidence to criminally charge any person, including Comey or Richmond. There's another potential theory of the prosecution's case, that Comey lied to the Senate about authorizing his then-deputy Andrew McCabe, a central figure in the Russia investigation, to speak to the press for a story about the FBI's investigations of the Clinton Foundation in 2016. The best explanation of the weakness of that theory comes from Andrew McCarthy, a former federal prosecutor and my friend and former colleague at National Review. Andy and I clashed frequently when I was at the magazine. We disagreed on the wisdom and merits of the Russia investigation. He thought it was a disgrace and wrote an entire book arguing that point. But he took one look at the Comey indictment and wrote that it was so ill-conceived and incompetently drafted, he should be able to get it thrown out on a pretrial motion to dismiss. The reason is simple. There is no credible evidence that Comey lied at all. As McCarthy notes, the indictment may center on confusion as to whether Comey lied when he said that he did not authorize his deputy, Andrew McCabe, to leak news to the Wall Street Journal that the FBI was investigating the Clinton Foundation. But there's no publicly available evidence that supports this claim. Comey told the Inspector General that McCabe definitely did not tell me that he authorized the leak. McCabe, for his part, told the Inspector General's office that he let Comey know the day after the story broke that he authorized the leak and that Comey did not react negatively, just kind of accepted it. Even if you believe McCabe over Comey, McCabe only said that he told Comey about the leak after it happened. As McCarthy writes, McCabe never even claimed that Comey authorized the leak, as that term is commonly understood. It's important to discuss the details of the case, but we cannot forget the context. The Department of Justice is prosecuting a former director of the FBI, and it's doing so not because there is clear evidence of a crime, but because there is clear evidence that the president wants revenge. Trump's Truth Social post, in fact, could well be Exhibit A in a motion to dismiss the case, or it could be one of the first pieces of evidence presented to a jury to show that this case has nothing to do with the truth and everything to do with obeying the orders of the most powerful man in the world. But it's even worse than that. Trump's retribution isn't just inflicting grave injustice on its innocent victims, it's hollowing the Justice Department. As decent people resign, they're replaced with people eager or at least willing to participate in Trump's partisan inquisitions. When you put it all together, there can be no doubt Trump's attack on American justice has taken its next and most ominous turn. Show me the man and I'll show you the crime. Those infamous words are the hallmarks of a corrupt state. Trump is now openly mimicking the dictators he admires so much. He has shown Pam Bondi the man, and Bondi's Department of Justice has manufactured the crime. serious stuff. And because my voice is giving out, we'll conclude with a couple of letters to the editor. Frank Bruni wrote an article called "Give Trump a Nobel and an Emmy and an Oscar." And here are a couple of letters in response, one by Dennis Brio from New Smyrna Beach, Florida. "I nominate Frank Bruni's essay, Give Trump a Nobel and an Emmy and an Oscar, for the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor, to present it this December at the John F. Kennedy Center for Performing Arts in Washington by President Trump. Maybe if Trump can take center stage to bedeck the New York Times and its media brethren more, he will bedevil them less." Here's another. I can't read the next word. I agree with Frank Bruni. "Give Donald Trump as many honors as possible while he's president. We should also carve his likeness on Mount Rushmore. Such a bold addition to the shrine of democracy would be an apt physical and historical bookend. Two founders on one side, Washington and Jefferson, and on the far right, the man who will likely bring the great American experiment to an end. Even if Trump is not successful at completely dismantling our democracy, his scowling visage would remind future generations of how close he came." That's by Lee Anderson from Redwood City, California, and David Hill from Mill Valley, California writes, "I propose to establish a new prize, the Neville Chamberlain Peace for Our Time Prize, and to nominate Donald J. Trump to be its first recipient." And then one last letter called "Infants and Screens." Regarding the article, "An Unwavering Warning About Teenagers and Screen Time," as a longtime advocate for preventing the tech and media industry's exploitation of children, I was pleased to see Gene Tweng's important work featured in this article. But teens and preteens are not the only children the tech industry targets and exploits. Parents of babies and toddlers are inundated with false marketing for apps and videos claiming, without evidence, to teach their youngest children everything from first words to counting to colors. In fact, research tells us that babies and toddlers learn best in relationship to caring adults, not from machines, and that hours with screens in infancy can affect brain development and are linked to language delays and other learning problems later in childhood. I fully support the phone-free schools movement, as well as other efforts to limit the tech industry's exploitation of adolescent vulnerabilities. But it's not enough to start there. It's crucial to recognize that excessive tech use often begins in infancy, and that its harms can be devastating to healthy growth and development. And that's by Susan Lin, and she's the author of What's Raising the Kids? Big Tech, Big Business, and the Lives of Children. And that will have to do for today. I hope you enjoyed this. I look forward to being again with you again next Monday. And you've been listening to a reading of articles and features on from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. This is Ted. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.